Yet Putin himself appeared to be not worried. He was, Steele wrote, generally satisfied with the progress of the anti-Clinton operation to date. There was an ominous warning in Steele's latest reports to Simpson. More was coming. The Russians had additional kompromat on Clinton, and consideration was being given to releasing it through plausibly deniable channels. More Clinton email dumps. That tracked with what Julian Assange and Roger Stone had been telegraphing. At this point, Simpson knew something that almost nobody else did. Steele had given his initial reports to the FBI, and the Bureau was reviewing them. So he figured out a way to put Steele's material to use. He would bring Steele to Washington and have him brief a small number of reporters. Then, he hoped, the reporters would tap their sources and sniff out what the FBI was doing with all of this. It might even prod the Bureau to take Steele's reports more seriously. Simpson focused on one of Steele's reports that had nothing to do with sex parties, a memo about the trip Carter Page, a member of the Trump foreign policy team, had made to Moscow in early July. Steele's report alleged that while there, Page had met with senior Russian officials, including Rosneft chief Igor Sechin, a Putin crony sanctioned by the United States over the Russian intervention in Ukraine. Page and Sechin supposedly discussed a possible deal about the lifting of sanctions under a Trump presidency. It was provocative and possibly checkable information that could well be evidence of collusion between the GOP candidate's campaign and the Kremlin. Simpson wasn't the only one thinking along these lines. In late August, Democratic Senate leader Harry Reid, while in his hometown of Las Vegas, had received an unexpected call from CIA Director John Brennan. Could he find a location where they could have a secure phone call? Brennan asked him. This was unusual. Of course, Reid said. He arranged to go to the local FBI office where he got a 15-minute briefing on a secure line on the latest intelligence about the Russian interference in the U.S. election. What Brennan told him that morning was the same briefing he was giving to the Gang of Eight, the majority and minority leaders of the House and Senate, and the top Democrats and Republicans on the two congressional intelligence committees. But the fact that he had reached out during the congressional recess to speak one-on-one with Reid was a sign of urgency. Brennan provided Reid the full picture. The intelligence community had concluded Moscow had pulled off the hacks of Democratic targets and the subsequent dumps of documents, and Putin was behind it. Worse, there were indications Moscow's covert tech operatives might try to mess with election systems and even tamper with the results. Brennan also shared the suspicions within the intelligence community that Trump associates had been in contact with Russians and possibly involved in the Russian clandestine campaign. After the call, Reid seemed shaken, according to an aide traveling with him. Reid also had the impression that Brennan had an ulterior motive. He concluded the CIA chief believed the public needed to know about the Russian operation, including the information about the possible links to the Trump campaign. When Reid later was asked if Brennan directly or indirectly had enlisted him to push information held by the intelligence community into the public realm, he told an interviewer, "Why do you think he called me?" So Reid went public. On August 27th, 2 days after his briefing, Reid wrote FBI Director Comey an extraordinary letter. He had recently become concerned that the threat of the Russian government tampering in our presidential election is more extensive than widely known and may include the intent to falsify official election results. Then he added, "The evidence of a direct connection between the Russian government and Donald Trump's presidential campaign continues to mount. The prospect of a hostile government actively seeking to undermine our free and fair elections represents one of the gravest threats to our democracy since the Cold War." These were startling claims. But Reid, every bit as fierce a partisan as his GOP counterpart McConnell, had an agenda. He wanted the FBI to investigate the Trump campaign, and he wanted the public to know about it. The links between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin, he wrote, needed to be probed thoroughly and in a timely fashion. And he set a deadline for the Bureau to release its findings to American voters before the election. Reid was a 29-year veteran of the Senate who had received many intelligence briefings. He knew Senate rules and the law as well as anybody. He couldn't use any details Brennan had told him in a classified briefing in a public letter. To back up his assertions of possible links between Trump operatives and the Russians, he mostly cited media reports. He mentioned an individual with long ties to Donald Trump, a reference to Roger Stone, who had claimed to be in communication with WikiLeaks. He talked about how the Trump campaign had employed people with significant and disturbing ties to the Kremlin, an apparent reference to Manafort and Flynn. Then, Reid cited something else that had not been the subject of any media coverage. He referred to a series of disturbing reports about a Trump advisor, a clear reference to Page, who gave a speech in Moscow in July and met with high-ranking sanctioned individuals. But there had been no news stories about such a meeting, and Reid didn't say what disturbing reports he was referring to or how he knew about them. Simpson would later say he never briefed Reid, but Elias, the Clinton campaign lawyer who was the attorney for Reid's super PAC, had briefed Mook about the alleged Page meetings in Moscow, and Clinton campaign officials were in regular touch with Reid. However Reid learned about the Page allegation, his reference to a meeting with sanctioned individuals was significant. Though no reporters picked up on that sentence, it was the first time Steele's unconfirmed reporting had seeped into the public discourse. 2 weeks after Reid's letter to Comey, Simpson and his Fusion GPS partner Peter Fritsch booked a private room at the Tabard Inn, a bohemian hotel and bar long a favorite of Washington journalists. It would serve as something of a private salon for Steele and reporters. Simpson invited investigative journalists who covered national security, not politics. He told them they would get to meet an impeccable source, a well-connected former intelligence operative who had some important information about Trump and the Russians. Among those Simpson invited for individual briefings at the Tabard that day were reporters for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN, and Yahoo News's Michael Isikoff. It was the first time Isikoff met Steele, and the journalist was impressed by his credentials. Steele explained who he was, a former MI6 spy who had served in Moscow. Wearing a starched white shirt, he was grave and all business. He was not there for small talk. Emphasizing that he believed what he had discovered was truly disturbing, Steele laid out his story about Carter Page and his trip to Moscow. He told Isikoff what had been reported to him from sources inside Russia, that Page had met with Rosneft chief Sechin, one of Putin's closest intimates, and they had discussed a possible deal for the lifting of sanctions. Steele also mentioned Page's supposed meeting with Igor Divakin, a top Putin aide. Steele wouldn't say anything about his sources. That was strictly confidential. After all, this was Russia, where sources could be shot or poisoned for talking about such matters. But Steele did mention that all this information had been reported to the FBI. That, more than anything, got Isikoff's attention. He pressed Steele. Had he personally briefed the FBI? You can assume that, Steele said, although he wouldn't say who he had briefed. What was the Bureau's reaction? Were they inclined to pursue it? Yes, Steele told Isikoff. There were people in the Bureau taking this very seriously. When Isikoff heard this, he realized he might have a potentially explosive lead. The FBI was investigating somebody in Trump's campaign. There were strict ground rules for this meeting. It was on background. That meant Steele could not be quoted by name or referred to as an ex-MI6 officer. He was to be described as a Western intelligence source, which was true, since he had been a steady source of intelligence for the FBI. But when Isikoff left the tabard, after a conversation that lasted about an hour, he figured he had more than enough to work with. When he got back to the office, Isikoff called Jonathan Weiner at the State Department. He had known Weiner for years. Simpson had told him Weiner could vouch for Steele. Weiner was overseas, but quickly got back to him. Yes, Steele was an absolutely reliable source, Weiner told him. Isikoff called another State Department official who had worked on Russian affairs. The source didn't know about Page's alleged meetings in Moscow, but knew about Page. U.S. officials had taken notice of his previous trips to Russia, as well as his provocative comments critical of U.S. policy and sympathetic to Putin. He was pretty much a brazen apologist for anything Moscow did, the official said. Isikoff also reached out to Page. He left him two voicemails and sent him two emails. In the last email, he said he wanted to talk to Page about his meetings in Moscow in July before writing any story. Page never responded. But Isikoff did get through to a senior U.S. law enforcement official. He asked about Reed's letter and its obvious reference to Page's alleged meeting with Sechin. It's on our radar screen, the official said. It's being looked at. Isikoff's story ran on the Yahoo website on September 23rd. U.S. intel officials probe ties between Trump advisor and Kremlin was the headline. It reported that officials were seeking to determine if Page had private communications with senior Russian officials about the possible lifting of economic sanctions if Trump became president. It quoted Reed's letter and cited a Western intelligence source, Steele, confirming intelligence reports, Steele's own reports, provided to U.S. officials about the allegation that Page had met with Sechin. Such a meeting, if confirmed, Isikoff wrote, would be viewed by U.S. officials as serious, given that Sechin had been blacklisted by the Treasury Department. It was the first story to report the existence of a U.S. intelligence investigation related to Russia and someone associated with the Trump campaign. Note, in September 2017, Page sued Oath Incorporated, which owned Yahoo and HuffPost, filing a complaint claiming this article had defamed him and endangered his life. He was acting as his own lawyer. End of note. 7 months later, the Washington Post would report that by the time of Isikoff's story, the FBI had already obtained a secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court warrant to monitor Page's communications after persuading a federal judge that there was probable cause to believe he was acting as an agent of a foreign power. Note, in January 2018, Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee prepared a classified memo alleging that Steele's reports were improperly used by the FBI as part of its application to obtain the FISA warrant. End of note. A few days after the Yahoo story, The Washington Post's Josh Rogan heard from Page and wrote a column about their conversation. Page told him the allegations in the article were just complete garbage, and that he had never met with Sechin or Devakin. Still, Page told Rogan, he was taking a leave of absence from the Trump campaign. Page gave Rogan a copy of a letter he had sent to Comey after the Yahoo story was posted. In the letter, Page said he would eagerly await the call from FBI agents so he could respond to these outrageous allegations. He didn't mention in the letter that while in Moscow, he had met with one of Sechin's deputies, and that after his trip, he had emailed the Trump campaign to say that he had obtained incredible insights from Russian legislators and senior members of Putin's regime. In Brooklyn, Clinton campaign officials jumped on Isikoff's story and promoted it to reporters. It's chilling to learn that U.S. intelligence officials are conducting a probe into suspected meetings between Trump's foreign policy advisor and members of Putin's inner circle while in Moscow, Glenn Kaplan, a Clinton aide working on the Russia issue, said in a statement released by the campaign. This is serious business, and voters deserve the facts before Election Day. By this point, reporters were beginning to call and tell campaign officials they were pursuing leads and rumors about other possible Trump-Russia ties, and they asked what the Clintonites had picked up. One story making the rounds among Washington reporters was that there was an unusual link between an email server associated with Trump's company and Alpha Bank, the largest private commercial bank in Russia. Clinton officials pushed journalists hard to dig into this, hoping that this would be the story to break through and define Trump as a Putin stooge. Coincidentally or not, Steele had just filed a new memo flagging the current closeness of the Alpha Group-Putin relationship and that significant favors continued to be done in both directions. Elias, the Democratic lawyer, was circumspect about what he did with Steele's memos. He would at times brief Mook on their contents, but he didn't want hard copies floating around and didn't share the actual reports with the campaign. An episode from 2012 was guiding his thinking. That year, the DCCC put out a press release claiming GOP billionaire megadonor and casino owner Sheldon Adelson was tied to the Chinese mob and a prostitution ring. Adelson threatened to sue the DCCC for defamation and libel, and with his deep pockets, he could have mounted a legal action that would crush the party organization. The DCCC issued a retraction and publicly apologized. Elias was not eager for a repeat of that experience, not with the famously litigious Trump. He knew what might result if any of Steele's memos, filled with unverified allegations, ever became public. And the dumps kept coming. DCLeaks.com posted email stolen from the Gmail account of Ian Melul, a young Democratic operative who had moved from the White House staff to Clinton's campaign. Days later, several media outlets posted a hacked audio that had been part of Melul's email files, and it captured Clinton at a February fundraiser describing Sanders supporters as children of the Great Recession who are living in their parents' basement. Clinton's foes jumped on this remark, claiming she was being dismissive of young people supporting Sanders, though her campaign maintained she had been expressing sympathy for frustrated young adults. Yet Trump once again exploited the Russian hacking operation, blasting Clinton for demeaning Sanders voters. In a tweet, he exclaimed, "Crooked H is nasty to Sanders supporters behind closed doors. Owned by Wall Street and politicians, HRC is not with you." September had not been kind to Clinton. Early in the month, she had given a speech decrying Trump for attracting racists, misogynists, homophobes, xenophobes, and Islamophobes, and she remarked that half of Trump supporters were a basket of deplorables, a phrase that backfired against her politically. And a few days later, she had almost collapsed at a 9/11 memorial service in New York City. She had been battling pneumonia at the time, but had kept that a secret. Donna Brazile, the interim DNC chair, would later write that she was so concerned about Clinton's health that she began thinking of ways to replace her on the Democratic ticket. Moreover, the polls tightened at the start of the month, though Clinton still maintained a close but respectable lead. Both campaigns were now planning for their first big showdown, the first of three debates, which would be held at Hofstra University on Long Island. There was no question the Russia issue would come up. About two-thirds of the way into the contentious debate, the moderator, NBC News anchor Lester Holt, asked Clinton, what could be done to thwart cyber attacks on the United States? Clinton hit the Russia connection hard. There is no doubt now that Russia has used cyber attacks against all kinds of organizations in our country, she said. And I am deeply concerned about this. I know Donald's very praiseworthy of Vladimir Putin, but Putin is playing a really tough, long game here, and one of the things he's done is to let loose cyber attackers to hack into government files, to hack into personal files, hack into the Democratic National Committee. And we recently have learned that, you know, that this is one of their preferred methods of trying to wreak havoc. Then, she brought up Trump's invitation to hack her deleted emails. I was so shocked when Donald publicly invited Putin to hack into Americans. That is just unacceptable. Trump, predictably, was dismissive of the whole issue, including the idea that Moscow had hacked the DNC. She is saying, Russia, 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 but I don't... Maybe it was. I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed who weighs 400 pounds, okay? He then wandered off to a strange place. So we have to get very, very tough on cyber and cyber warfare. It is a huge problem. I have a son. He's 10 years old. He has computers. He is so good with these computers. It's unbelievable. On September 28th, Jim Comey sat down at a table in a committee room of the House Rayburn Office Building and prepared to be grilled by members of Congress. The occasion was a regular public oversight hearing conducted by the House Judiciary Committee. But the most pressing question for the Democrats was what the FBI was doing to investigate connections between the Trump campaign and Russia. Is the FBI investigating the activities of Mr. Trump or any advisor to the Trump campaign with respect to any line of communication between the campaign and the Russian government? Representative John Conyers of Michigan, the senior Democrat on the panel, asked. Comey replied without hesitation, I can't say, sir. We don't confirm or deny investigations. Another Democratic member asked if the FBI had questioned Roger Stone about his communications with Julian Assange or his interactions with WikiLeaks. Comey answered, I can't comment on that. What about Paul Manafort and his work in Ukraine? Again, no comment. Comey was asked about the statement recently issued by Feinstein and Schiff that said, Russian intelligence agencies are making a serious and concerted effort to influence the U.S. election. Comey responded, I can't comment on that in this forum. Democrats on the panel became exasperated. There was no word coming out of the federal government about the Russian assault, which was targeting their party and its nominees, or the suspicions widely held within the intelligence community that there were some odd associations between Trump's world and Moscow. Comey, the Democrats pointed out, had in a rather public manner discussed the Clinton email server investigation in a major departure from FBI policy. So why not be even-handed and disclose whether the Trump campaign was the subject of an investigation? Is there a different standard for Secretary Clinton and Donald Trump? Asked Representative Jerry Nadler of New York. No, Comey replied. Our standard is we do not confirm or deny the existence of investigations. There is an exception for that, when there is a need for the public to be reassured, when it is obvious, it is apparent, given our activities, public activities, that the investigation is ongoing. But our overwhelming rule is we do not comment except in certain exceptional circumstances. Comey was in a box. In the case of Clinton, the Bureau's probe had become public because the inspectors general of the intelligence community and the State Department had each made referrals to the Justice Department about the former secretary's handling of classified information, and that step had been reported to the Congress. But the Trump campaign probe fell into a different category. It was a counterintelligence investigation, by its nature classified. It involved ongoing activity involving suspected Russian intelligence agents. There was no way Comey could publicly confirm its existence without tipping off some of the suspects and sabotaging the work of his own agents. In early October, Steele traveled from London to Rome to meet with FBI agent Mike Gaeta. It was a follow-up session to their earlier meeting in London in July. Headquarters considered this a highly serious matter. Four senior FBI counterintelligence officials flew over from Washington to sit in. Gaeta had told Steele that the Bureau was prepared to cover his travel expenses. The FBI pumped Steele for information about his memos. Who were his sources and how was the material collected? Steele was careful. He couldn't reveal much without endangering the lives of his sub-sources who were talking to his main collector. FBI meetings with informants and sources are often one-way streets. The agents take in what the subjects say and reveal little, if anything, of what they already know. But Steele was a former officer in an Allied intelligence service and had a solid track record. So the agents revealed a striking piece of intelligence to him. They had heard things related to the Trump campaign, Steele recalled. The Bureau, he was told, had received information on contacts between suspected Kremlin cutouts and George Papadopoulos. This was a reference to the report the Australian government had passed to Washington 2 months earlier, revealing that Papadopoulos had told an Aussie diplomat that Russia had dirt on Clinton. The Bureau wanted to determine what Steele might have to add. It made Steele an offer. The Bureau would provide him a $50,000 contract if he worked with the FBI and supplied information about links between the Trump campaign and Moscow. Later on, Steele would insist that the money was beside the point. The contract would never be implemented, and Steele would not even be reimbursed the £1,200 he spent on the Rome trip. "I wasn't asking them for money," he remarked. "I was coming forward because it was my duty. We were seeing stuff on the ground that affected national security. It was fucking obvious what was going on." That is, there was a Russian active measures operation to penetrate the Trump campaign. "We were doing the right thing," he added, and he would defend his work. "You think if I was peddling false information about Russia, I'd still be in business?" In the early days of October, Roger Stone once again began to stir the pot. At 12:52 a.m. on Sunday, October 2nd, Stone tweeted, "Wednesday, at Hillary Clinton is done. Hashtag WikiLeaks." Later that same day, Stone appeared on the show of InfoWars conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and declared, "I'm assured the motherlode is coming Wednesday." The release would be devastating, he predicted. He also asserted that Assange was scared the globalists and the Clintonites are trying to figure out how to kill him. And on October 3rd, Stone put out this tweet, "I have total confidence that at WikiLeaks and my hero Julian Assange will educate the American people soon. Hashtag lock her up." Clinton aides were watching Stone's tweets the way seismologists look for tremors before the big quakes. And these tweets were seen as a code red warning sign. But they weren't the only ones paying close attention. Donald Trump Jr. had intermittently been in private contact with WikiLeaks, and now he wanted to know more about Stone's taunting prediction. A couple of weeks earlier, on September 20th, the WikiLeaks Twitter account had sent him a private message asking him about a new election blog called PutinTrump.org that had been created by a political action committee funded by a liberal internet entrepreneur. "Off the record, I don't know who that is, but I'll ask around," Trump Jr. replied. And he emailed Bannon, Kushner, and Conway about his exchange with WikiLeaks. Now, on October 3rd, WikiLeaks contacted him again with a private request. "Hiya, it'd be great if you guys could comment on push this story," WikiLeaks suggested, attaching an article alleging, probably falsely, that Clinton had once suggested she wanted to just drone Assange. "Already did that earlier today," Trump Jr. responded. "It's amazing what she can get away with." 2 minutes later, Trump Jr., now looking for some inside information, messaged WikiLeaks. Referring to the Stone tweet, he asked, "What's behind this Wednesday leak I keep reading about?" In this instance, WikiLeaks didn't respond. In the weeks since Obama had warned Putin to cut it out, White House officials had continued to grapple with what to do about Russia's actions. With the failure to win over McConnell, Obama and his top advisors had decided that the administration itself would have to issue a statement tagging Moscow as responsible for the hacks. Some cabinet members disagreed, arguing that intelligence sources and methods could be compromised, or that issuing an attribution might, in and of itself, undermine the election. But the intelligence kept getting stronger. One report circulating at this time revealed that after WikiLeaks had dumped the DNC emails in July, Kremlin officials were congratulating themselves on a job well done. "We all looked at it and said, 'Fuck,'" one official who reviewed the report later said. "The Russians were talking, telling one another, 'Great job!' It was pretty specific. They were celebrating their success. In the end, we concluded we had to tell the public what we knew and that it would be unforgivable if we did not," Jay Johnson, the Homeland Security Secretary, recalled. Clapper, too, now argued forcefully for saying something. "If the election did go south for one reason or another, and then afterwards it was learned that we knew about what the Russians were doing and sat silent, there'd be hell to pay," he subsequently said. The intelligence community was instructed to compose a statement that could be released. To do so meant crafting language that would not blow any secret sources or methods. After working on this for over a month, an amount of time that White House officials considered excessive, the agencies finally had a draft that represented the consensus of the various spy services agencies that Russia was the culprit. In early October, the principals met twice to discuss the statement and assess the status of the Russian operation. Clapper and Brennan both reported that Russian cyber attacks related to the election seemed to have diminished since Obama's meeting with Putin. There was some activity, but it was hard to figure out how significant it was. There was no intelligence suggesting major new cyber pokes at the election system. "We thought we could ride out the influence campaign the Russians were running against the Democrats and that it was not a big deal," one participant in these meetings recalled. "We were still much more agitated the Russians could rig the election." And the White House and the intelligence community were oblivious to the other major element of Putin's operation, a vast social media campaign targeting the American electorate. The intelligence community had come up with a statement that attributed the hack and dump operation to the Russian government and that noted the probing of state election systems was related to Russian servers. It did not state that the Kremlin operation aimed to place Trump in the White House. The intelligence on this point was not yet definitive. All the relevant agencies, including the FBI, CIA, NSA, and DHS, signed off on the conclusions. But over the course of the two meetings, the principals reviewed the wording carefully, even discussing the moving of commas. The intent was to make sure the statement came across as professional and even a bit banal. Just the facts, nothing unnecessarily dramatic. "We were being overly cautious," one participant later noted. "If we played this wrong, we could play into the Russians' hands." One sentence in particular was debated during these meetings, the one that stated that Putin had authorized the operation. A near-to-final draft asserted that Putin had personally okayed the information warfare campaign. Given that Putin was the leader of an authoritarian regime, it certainly made sense. But there was concern among some principals that explicitly naming Putin as the ringleader would be an overly provocative step and could possibly endanger some of the intelligence community's sources. After much discussion, Putin's name was deleted. Instead, the principals opted for less specific wording, fingering senior Kremlin officials. The final draft was produced, and it bore the logos of all the intelligence agencies involved to show that the entire intelligence community, the FBI, the NSA, the CIA, and others, agreed on the finding. Then, in the final principals' meeting, Comey raised an objection. He did not want to attach the FBI to the statement. "It was a jaw-dropping moment," one participant recalled. This was especially so because during the summer, Comey had drafted a newspaper op-ed blaming the Russians that the White House had scuttled. But now, with the election closer, Comey had second thoughts. Is this because you don't agree with the conclusions? Comey was asked. No, Comey said. He told the others he was worried that it would look as if the FBI was putting its thumb on the scale right before an election. There had long been a tradition of the Bureau not engaging in public actions close to an election that might influence a race. He did not want to tarnish the FBI's reputation by signing on to a statement that could be viewed as political. Comey did not share what was still a closely held secret, that the Bureau had already launched its counterintelligence investigation of Kremlin contacts with the Trump campaign. The absence from the statement of the FBI, which had principal responsibility for counterintelligence inside the United States, would look curious and undoubtedly raise questions. Comey's move could undermine the whole point of issuing an assessment, some officials feared. The principals discussed other options. At one point in the Situation Room, Clapper slipped Johnson a note saying, "Why don't we just issue a joint statement?" And Johnson proposed that DHS and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which represented the entire intelligence community, release the statement in their agency's names. That settled the matter. No one would know that Comey had been unwilling to have the FBI identified with it. Obama and his advisors decided it would be best to release the statement with little fanfare, with no comment from the president. Obama would not use his bully pulpit to heighten the message being delivered by the intelligence community. The White House wanted to squeeze politics out of this as much as possible. "We were wearing self-imposed handcuffs," a senior White House aide later said. "We would not allow anyone to suggest the president had stepped out of bounds and was using this for political ends." There was a last-minute hiccup. In the principal's meetings, Kerry suggested delaying the statement until after his upcoming talks with Sergei Lavrov in Lausanne, where once again he would be trying to resolve the Syrian conflict. But Obama and other principals wanted the statement out right away. It was scheduled to be released on Friday, October 7th. Chapter 18. Only Russia's senior-most officials could have authorized these activities. October 7th began with a hurricane, a real one. A Category 4 storm named Matthew had wreaked havoc on the Caribbean, and now it was heading toward the Florida coast. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson was at the White House updating Obama on disaster preparations when he received a call saying that the Clinton campaign had requested a briefing for the candidate. Sure, Johnson thought, but to be fair, he would also have to offer one to Trump. Shortly after noon, he called Clinton from FEMA headquarters. She asked a few smart questions, including about an arcane matter related to disaster relief legislation that had passed when she was in the Senate. Afterward, Johnson called Trump and had a conversation he would later describe to colleagues as surreal. On the speakerphone in his Trump Tower office, the candidate was gregarious. "Hey, Jay, how you doing?" Trump said. "You're doing a great job. Everybody says you're doing a great job." Johnson filled him in on the government preparations for the hurricane. Then Trump asked, "What are you doing when you leave office?" Johnson replied he would be returning to his law firm in New York. "When this is over," Trump said, "why don't you come over to the tower and we'll have lunch?" Johnson was taken aback. Trump was running for president. If he won, he would be in the White House, not Trump Tower. "There are some scenarios," Johnson gently pointed out, "where we might have to have lunch in Washington, not New York." "Oh, yeah," Trump replied, as though he had not considered the possibility. Johnson's top aides, who were listening in on the call, were incredulous. It seemed like Trump hadn't given any thought to the idea that he might actually win. After Johnson got off the phone, his attention turned toward the joint statement he and Clapper had agreed to put out that day, officially attributing the hack to Russia. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence was finishing its declassification. It would be released within hours on a Friday afternoon. Having spoken to both candidates, Johnson pondered the weirdness of the moment. They had no idea of the bombshell we're about to drop on both of them, he thought. The U.S. government in modern times had never accused a foreign nation of intervening in the American political process. Johnson was convinced the release would drive the news cycle. He was wrong. That morning, Clinton's debate team had set up at the Doral Arrowwood Resort in Rye Brook, New York, for a prep session with the candidate. In 2 days, Clinton would face Trump for their second debate. The group included Jennifer Palmieri, Jake Sullivan, John Podesta, Joel Benenson, the campaign's chief strategist, longtime Democratic advisors Ron Klain, Jim Margolis, and Mandy Grunwald, and others. No, Bill Clinton. Playing Trump was Philippe Reines, who had been Clinton's combative and abrasive spokesman at the State Department. Clinton arrived around midday, and they began work. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the news broke. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI, and the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, had released the statement declaring that the U.S. intelligence community was confident that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including from U.S. political organizations. It noted the release of the stolen material by DCLeaks.com, WikiLeaks, and Guccifer 2.0 was consistent with the methods and motivations of Russian-directed efforts. These thefts and disclosures are intended to interfere with the U.S. election process. And it stated that only Russia's senior-most officials could have authorized these activities. The statement added, some states have also recently seen scanning and probing of their election-related systems, which in most cases originated from servers operated by a Russian company. However, we are not now in a position to attribute this activity to the Russian government. But it seemed clear, by its inclusion in the statement, that the intelligence community was suggesting Moscow could be targeting America's electoral infrastructure. The Clintonites were ecstatic. The White House had not tipped them off, but it was exactly what they wanted. Finally, the Obama administration was backing up what the campaign had been saying for months. It seemed like this would have to reshape the conversation of the remainder of the campaign, Benenson said. Now, the media finally would have to make this story a priority, Benenson and other campaign aides believed. Clinton was somewhat more skeptical. Although she was delighted with the statement, she told her aides she wasn't quite certain that reporters covering the campaign would pay sufficient attention to it. In Brooklyn, the senior Clinton aides not doing debate prep huddled in Mook's office and got the debate group on the phone. They decided to put out a statement designed to apply pressure on Trump to acknowledge the Russians were meddling in the election. After that was done, Mook and other Clinton officials or surrogates would contact reporters to talk up the development. The Clinton aides believed they now had a solid basis for asking the media to reject future email dumps and concentrate on what they considered the real story, the Russian war on the 2016 election. Across the East River, in Trump Tower, the Republican candidate was in the 24th floor conference room with his top advisors doing his own debate prep. When news of the intelligence community Homeland Security statement reached them, they didn't pay it any mind. It was so unimportant, David Bossie, the Trump campaign's deputy manager, recalled. The campaign's tact had been to ignore the Russian story, give it no oxygen. That is, when Trump and his advisors were not dismissing it in public. Besides, Trump and his team had something much bigger to worry about. In the middle of the prep session, Bossie's phone rang. On the line was campaign spokeswoman Hope Hicks. She had been contacted by Washington Post reporter David Farenthold. He was asking for a comment from the campaign about a story he was about to publish. Farenthold had been sent a video of Trump making lewd comments about women. The footage was shot in 2005 when Trump was a guest on the Access Hollywood Entertainment News Show. Trump was riding on the Access Hollywood bus with host Billy Bush. Not realizing his mic was live, Trump crudely boasted about sexually pursuing a married woman and sexually assaulting women. "You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them," he told Bush. "It's like a magnet. Just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything. Grab him by the pussy. You can do anything." Farenthold had sent Hicks a transcript of Trump's comments on the video. Bossie's initial thought was, pure and simple, this was a last-minute Clinton-Oppo research hit to influence the Sunday debate. He and campaign chairman Steve Bannon left the room to discuss how to respond. Soon they were joined by Kushner, Hicks, and Jason Miller, the campaign communications director. Those inside the conference room could see through a glass wall that something was happening. The group outside went back in, joining Trump, Christie, who was playing Hillary Clinton, and Reince Priebus, the Republican Party chair. They showed Trump the transcript. He dismissed it. "It doesn't sound like me," he said. Then Hicks got an update from Farenthold. The Post had decided to send the campaign the video. Together, they all watched on Bossie's iPad. Still, the candidate was unfazed. He didn't dwell on the contents. "What are we going to do about it?" he asked his aides. By now, Ivanka Trump was in the room. Her eyes welled with tears, her face reddened. She urged her father to make a full-throated apology. Christie did the same. Trump didn't want to do it. Instead, he, Bannon, Bossie, and Miller quickly drafted a statement for the Post. It was short and considerably less than what Ivanka was pleading for. Naturally, it took a shot at the Clintons. This was locker room banter, a private conversation that took place many years ago. "Bill Clinton has said far worse to me on the golf course, not even close. I apologize if anyone was offended." Hicks sent it to the Post. With the statement from Trump, Farenthold and the Post wrapped up their story. At 4:02 p.m., Farenthold tweeted, "Stand by for some news about @RealDonaldTrump." 1 minute later, his story went live. At the White House, officials were bracing for what they assumed was going to be a huge news day driven by the Russia statement. And at first, it was. The release of the statement capped months of speculation about what the administration knew about Russia's interference in the election, and pinning it on the highest levels of the Russian government was a surprise. "My phone was ringing constantly," recalled Ned Price, the NSC spokesman. He was inundated with emails from reporters asking about the statement. And then, suddenly, Price said, the phone stopped ringing. At first, he didn't realize why. Then, he understood. Todd Breciel, the senior spokesman at the Department of Homeland Security, filled Price in on what was happening. Breciel had just been on the phone with a top network correspondent who was planning a piece that evening about the ODNI-DHS statement. This was huge. It was unprecedented, the correspondent was saying. The United States was calling out Russia for screwing with our democracy. Then Breciel heard the correspondent barking to a colleague, "Oh, fuck. Unmute the TV." The cable news channels were playing the Access Hollywood tape nonstop, showing Trump time and again making his outrageous comments about women. "You're not going to fucking believe this. There goes my story," the correspondent shouted over the phone. "I gotta go." The correspondent hung up. At the Doral Arrowwood, Clinton and her aides were taking a break from debate prep when the news reports of the Access Hollywood video hit. At first, no one said anything. Clinton stared at the screen in absolute disbelief. After a brief discussion with her senior staff about what, if anything, she should say, Clinton put out a brief statement on Twitter. "This is horrific. We cannot allow this man to become president." Many top Republicans at that moment were having the same thought. At Trump Tower, the candidate and his advisors were watching their support from the party establishment crumble. Jeb Bush tweeted, As the grandfather of two precious girls, I find that no apology can excuse away Donald Trump's reprehensible comments degrading women. Mitt Romney declared, "Hitting on married women, condoning assault, such vile degradations demean our wives and daughters and corrupt America's face to the world." Priebus commented, "No woman should ever be described in these terms or talked about in this manner, ever." Ryan disinvited Trump from a campaign event, saying he was sickened by Trump's remarks. Senator John McCain announced, "The disclosure of his demeaning comments about women and his boasts about sexual assaults make it impossible to continue to offer even conditional support for his candidacy." Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz called Trump's words some of the most abhorrent and offensive comments that you can possibly imagine, and withdrew his support. It looked like a death blow to Trump's campaign. As devastating as the video was to Trump, some Clinton campaign staffers still wanted to keep the focus on Russia. Ignoring the nonstop cable coverage of the video, Brian Fallon, the press secretary, and Glenn Kaplan, the Oppo man, had crafted a statement. "The world now knows, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the hack of the Democratic National Committee was carried out by the Russian government in a clear attempt to interfere with the integrity of our elections," it declared. "The only remaining question is why Donald Trump continues to make apologies for the Russians." The Clinton staffers hit the phones, calling reporters they had worked with, urging them to give more attention to the Russia story. They weren't having much luck, and the surprises that day weren't over. At 4:32 p.m. came the WikiLeaks tweet. "Release the Podesta emails." At that moment, the group was posting about 2,000 of Podesta's emails from his personal Gmail account and reporting that it had more than 50,000 of his emails in its possession. It was the October surprise the Clinton people had anticipated and feared. Palmieri pulled Podesta out of debate prep to let him know his emails were out. Podesta and other Clinton aides were convinced. This was strategically timed to fuck them and distract from both the Russia statement and the grab-em-by-the-pussy video. They even suspected, given Stone's public tweets, that it was coordinated with the Trump campaign. The timing was not coincidental, Podesta later said. They needed Fox News to have something to talk about. This day had become almost too intense for some Clinton officials. The swings were overwhelming. Palmieri could barely stand the increased stress. At one point, she had to call a timeout for herself. She left her colleagues and walked the perimeter of the resort, listening to a Bruce Springsteen song, "Take 'em as they come." Perkins Coie, the campaign's law firm, began to download the Podesta material and make sure the documents were not laced with malware or other cyber bombs. In the Brooklyn headquarters, handling email dumps had become routine. The campaign already had a war room set up for reviewing hacked material. The previous day, DCLeaks.com had released emails from Capricia Marshall, a longtime Clinton confidant, and now, a dozen or so researchers turned from those messages to scouring the Podesta emails. Though campaign officials had feared that Podesta's emails would be leaked, the campaign had not preemptively reviewed them. Podesta had not wanted campaign researchers sifting through all his messages. He knew there was sensitive material within this trove, emails that could bruise feelings and cause unease within the conflict-ridden Clinton world. But now, Podesta had no choice. The campaign needed to know what was in these emails, especially since WikiLeaks had released only a small slice of the collection of tens of thousands. Presumably, more were coming. He gave the campaign access to his account. The researchers in the war room soon began combing through the full Podesta cache, starting with the ones WikiLeaks had dumped. Looking for material that might cause problems, they conducted keyword searches. The list was obvious. Email server, the Clinton Foundation, Benghazi, Goldman Sachs, Obama, Sanders. Campaign officials, Mook, Kaplan, Fallon, and others tried their own effort at damage control. They jumped on the phone with reporters and urged them not to write about the WikiLeaks dump. The message they pushed out was simple. This is a Russia-orchestrated October surprise, and our campaign is being attacked by Putin. As Mook saw it, it was as if a criminal Russian super PAC working on behalf of Trump had stolen information from Podesta and was releasing it to save a candidate who was now facing annihilation. They asked the journalists to think twice before reporting on the material. But it was a futile exercise. The Clinton folks could not challenge the authenticity of the emails or point to any that had been doctored. And it was soon clear there was plenty of juicy material to be mined. Some of it was merely amusing, like a June 2015 email thread about a request from CNN's Tapper to interview Clinton. "Why is Jake Tapper such a dick?" Podesta had written. Tapper posted Podesta's comment with his own commentary. "It's a question that has confounded millions of people for hundreds of years." Within hours, more serious emails were discovered. A January 25, 2016 email to Podesta and other top campaign officials contained excerpts of Clinton's paid speeches to various groups, including Goldman Sachs and other financial institutions. Through the course of the campaign, Clinton had refused to release the transcripts of these speeches. They were a reminder of her unseemly buck-raking from Wall Street banks and other special interest groups during the run-up to her presidential campaign, an issue that was an easy target for Sanders and his supporters. It reminded many in the media of her well-documented penchant for secrecy. Campaign officials knew what was in the speeches. They had dissected them at the start of the primary season and urged Clinton to make them public, arguing there was nothing embarrassing or troubling enough that was worth the flack she was taking for her failure to do so. But Clinton refused to budge. "I'm being asked to put out more information than other candidates," she complained to her aides. Once Trump emerged as the GOP nominee, she had a new argument. "Why should I release my speeches if he won't release his tax returns?" Now, that decision came back to haunt her. The first significant stories on the Podesta emails focused on the Clinton campaign's own internal assessment of the speech transcripts and the passages that could be exploited by her opponents. In one 2013 speech to a Brazilian bank, Clinton had said, "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders." Reporters and Trump supporters latched on to open borders. Was Clinton suggesting the elimination of border controls? Clinton insisted she was referring to cross-border energy supplies. In a 2013 speech hosted by Goldman Sachs, she had suggested that Wall Street insiders could be tapped to better regulate the financial industry. "And the people that know the industry better than anybody are the people who work in the industry," she said. In a 2014 speech to Goldman and BlackRock, another big Wall Street firm, she described herself as kind of far removed from the middle-class upbringing she grew up in. Perhaps more worrisome for the campaign was an excerpt from a 2013 speech to an apartment industry group in which she discussed the need for a politician to balance the public and the private efforts needed to pass legislation and implement policy. "Politics is like sausage being made," she had said. "It is unsavory, so you need both a public and a private position." The initial news reports zeroed in on this remark as evidence of Clinton's political hypocrisy. The Republican National Committee jumped on the emails. It's not hard to see why she fought so hard to keep her transcripts of speeches to Wall Street banks paying her millions of dollars a secret, RNC Chair Priebus said in a statement. "The truth that has been exposed here is that the persona Hillary Clinton has adopted for her campaign is a complete and utter fraud." The Clintonites realized that no matter how hard they tried, they could not sell the Russian attack as the main story. "There were no stories saying, 'Holy shit, this Russian stuff is incredible,'" said Mook. As for Clinton, she was frustrated, but she was used to this. She told her advisors that she had taken incoming attacks through her entire political life and cautioned them not to become distracted. Trump and his advisors had bigger problems. They were confronting mounting calls for him to drop out of the race. They realized his initial statement to the Post, with its reference to locker room banter, was not